Welcome to the Issue Biz Podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, we sit down with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., perhaps the most controversial presidential candidate of all. We went to his L.A. area home for an extended and exclusive discussion where we talked about the big misconceptions about him, about COVID, about vaccines, about the economy, about why he's challenging Joe Biden, about his fight with the DNC, about what he thinks about Donald Trump. We talked about immigration and his trip to the border. We talked about Governor Newsom and his relationship with him. We talked about his father and his uncle and his other uncle and his wife, of course, Curb Your Enthusiasm star Cheryl Hines, and how Larry David introduced them. There is a lot in this conversation. A lot of what he says is often twisted by the media, who often doesn't let him speak. So here you get a chance to let him speak in full. He said, take as much time as you want. And so I said, let's hear from him. So here is that full, unedited conversation.
Bobby Kennedy Jr., thank you so much for having us. Welcome to The Issue Is.
Alex, thank you for having me.
And what a beautiful home you have. And it's especially cool to see that bust of your father behind you as well, to remind us where we are. So usually, this is the last question I ask somebody, but I think it's important to ask you as the first question. What do you think is the biggest misconception about you?
I think most, if all you're watching is CNN, MSNBC, and reading the New York Times, I think almost everything that you would believe about me would be a misconception. I don't think there's any, and I'm not complaining, but I'm making an observation that I don't think, everything that has been said about me on those, there's almost nothing that I would say was accurate.
What's the thing that bothers you the most?
Well, the worst thing that, the most, a lot of odious things have been said about me. I think the worst one was the anti-Semitism charge, racism, anti-Semitism. The vaccine stuff I've heard for many years. People call me anti-vax. I've never been anti-vaccine. I've said that thousands and thousands of times. I think most Americans, if they understood my view of vaccines, would agree 100% with me. I think everybody who wants a vaccine ought to be able to get one. I don't think people should be forced to take any kind of a medical intervention against their will. I think people should have good information, and that the science on vaccines should be robust. That we should know, we should be able to, each of us, make an accurate assessment about whether any medical product is going to avert more problems than it's going to cause, whether it's right for us. And I think we ought to do everything we can to free the public health agencies from corrupting entanglements with the pharmaceutical industry. We see that, what it did with the opioid crisis, it's doing that. It has that same impact in the entire realm of public health regulation.
So we know you say you're not anti-vax. We know that you've taken vaccines yourself. Your kids have taken vaccines as well. What vaccines would you be pro? Would you recommend people?
Well, I would support, it's like anything. I would support any, if a vaccine did what it said it was going to do, which is to prevent me from getting sick. So if I took that product 5 years from now, I would be healthier and more likely to be alive than I didn't. And I would take that product, but we need those kind of studies. And unfortunately, those studies aren't done. It's the only medical product that does not have to do pre-licensing safety studies. So none of the 72 vaccines that are now mandated for our children has ever been studied pre-licensing in a placebo-controlled trial, where you test health outcomes in the vaccinated population and the against the unvaccinated population, and look at total health outcomes over the next 4 or 5 years. That's never been done for any vaccine. So what I say is, let's do those studies. Yeah. and then let physicians know what the outcomes are, and let the public know, and let people make their own choices.
The CDC this week recommending the COVID vaccine for everybody 6 months and up. What do you make of that?
They don't have the data to do that. And this is a new vaccine that's never been tested at all in any study. So, nobody can point to a study and said, we've studied this in children, adults, pregnant women, or any cohort. It's never been studied for any purpose. The Pfizer vaccine was studied, but that was the original product. This product has never been studied.
This new strain hasn't been studied?
It's not only a new strain, it's new manufacturing process, it's new ingredients, it's proteins that we've never seen before. And it's never been studied. There's literally never been a single clinical trial on it. So I don't think FDA had any business making that recommendation without, knowing what the outcomes are.
On the COVID front, obviously there's a lot of mistakes that were made that we can look at, now with hindsight. If you're president and we have another pandemic, what do you think was the biggest lesson learned from what we went through that would impact how you handle going forward?
I think we did everything wrong. We had a pandemic protocols for 50 years, and we decided to violate them all. The pandemic protocol said you do not do broad-based lockdowns. You quarantine the sick, you protect the vulnerable, but you let society continue operating, because if you don't do that, the lockdown's going to kill more people than the pandemic, unless you have, a 50% infection fatality rate. And this is what, WHO protocols, CDC protocols, the European Union protocols, the UK protocols all said that. So, clearly what we should do is we had a militarized and monetized response to the pandemic. And because of that, our country, which probably most thoroughly implemented these recommendations, had the worst health outcomes of any country in the world. We have in the United States 4.2% of the world's population, but we had 16% of the COVID deaths. So we had the highest body count from COVID of any nation. So that's not a good outcome. That, people should not be getting awards for that outcome.
Right.
What we should have done is we had all these opportunities because of the internet of linking all 15 million doctors, frontline doctors, every country in the world, and finding out on a daily basis what they're doing that's working. And, and we know that there were a lot of therapies and a lot of treatments that were very, very good. The intubation was lethal to people that they used, widely in this country. The remdesivir was absolutely lethal to people. There are lots and lots of therapeutic drugs that were devastatingly effective against COVID, and they were not, in fact, they were deliberately suppressed. And the reason they were deliberately suppressed was because there's a little known federal law that says that you cannot give an emergency use authorization to a vaccine if there is an existing drug that has been approved for any purpose that is shown to be effective against the target disease. Mm. So the people who wanted to make the vaccine the only outcome that that Americans could use, purposely suppressed the use of therapeutic drugs that were known, were demonstrated in literally hundreds of studies. There are 400 studies today. Yeah. On hydroxychloroquine, there are over 100 studies on ivermectin that demonstrate efficacy.
And another reason that we probably had worse outcomes in a lot of places is because it really impacted people that are obese. And we have very little conversation in this country about health care. We talk about
sick chronic disease.
And about incentivizing working out, physical fitness, things like that.
And vitamin D, which almost everybody who died from COVID had vitamin D deficiencies, and we were never told to improve our vitamin D, and particularly people with darker colored skin, black Americans who had the highest death rates, were not told those things. And as you say, One of the reasons we had the highest death rate in this country, we had the highest chronic disease rate. We have the largest chronic disease burden of any country in the world. Our population has greater obesity, more neurological disorders, more allergic diseases, autoimmune diseases like diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus. And CDC says that the average American who died from COVID had 3.8 chronic diseases. So they were obese, they had asthma, they had diabetes, and they had one other. And we need to ask ourselves, why are we the sickest population in the world? Why is this the sickest generation of children in the world? Why, when my uncle was president, did 6% of our people have chronic disease, and today 54% do? You know, this is a national security issue. It is clearly a public health issue. It's also the most important economic issue, that and war. We spend $4.3 trillion annually on public health. 80% of that goes to treat chronic disease. And, you know, we don't need to have all this chronic disease. We know that the chronic disease epidemic began in 1989. And because EPA, Congress ordered EPA to study it, and that's what they said. Mm-hmm. And so what happened that year that, you know, changed the health of so many Americans? And clearly it's a conspiracy of different causes. It's our children today are swimming around in a toxic soup. You know, and there are many, many chemicals that exposures that follow that timeline. So glyphosate from Roundup, neonicotinoid pesticides, atrazine, which is in most of our water supply today, PFOAs, I've litigated on almost all of these issues, a flame retardant that was put in all of our furniture around that time and all childhood pajamas. There's a multitude, but it's a limited number of possible culprits. And, you know, NIH has a $42 billion annual budget. It distributes that among 56,000 scientists who are supposed to be studying ways to make us healthier. Yet those studies have never been done. And, you know, that's inexcusable. And that's one of the first things that I'll do as president is to say, let's find out what's causing this chronic disease epidemic and let's end those exposures.
Let's talk about your campaign. Behind you, we see this bust of your father, which reminds me of the fact that there's a bust of your father in the Oval Office with President Biden. I know you've said that you have a lot of affection for him as a man, your family has been friends with him for decades, and that this isn't a personal attack on him, you just have differing views. Why the decision to run for president? Why the decision to run at the same time that there is an incumbent Democratic president?
Well, you know, I said in my announcement, and this has been the persistent theme of my campaign, is that, and my 40 years, you know, as an advocate, public health, environmental advocate, we need to end this corrupt merger of state and corporate power, which is destroying our country. We're seeing a disintegration of everything we value about this country, you know, that collaboration, which has emerged to really overshadow our democracy, is responsible for the forever wars that are bankrupting the middle class, that are causing this inflationary spiral, that are importing, that are turning us into an imperium abroad and a surveillance state, a security state, a garrison state at home. It's also responsible for the poisoning of our water, of our environment, of our food supply. The foods that we get now don't even have nutrients in them. They're fillers, essentially, particularly the food that's available to the poor in this country, and they're loaded with toxins, and that is because of the corruption of democracy, the subversion of democracy. And it's also it's causing this extraordinarily systematic shift in wealth upward, away from the working poor, away from the middle class, to create this new aristocracy of billionaires in this country. During the COVID pandemic, we closed down 3.3 million businesses in this country. 41% of the black-owned businesses will never reopen. We created a billionaire a day. So we shifted $4 trillion of wealth upward. We created, in 500 days of lockdown, we created 500 new billionaires. Yeah. And we taught everybody in this country to use Amazon, to close down, you know, to forsake the local retailers, right, who are now, you know, all boarded up. And those are the people who pay local taxes, who, you know, who enrich our community, who give jobs to your summer jobs to your kids, who, you know, who finance the local Boy Scouts, who, right, pay for the Little League and the, you know, the hockey jerseys. And they're all gone. And now they taught us all how to use Amazon. And it's like magic. You order something and it shows up at your door, you know, 12 hours later. But Amazon doesn't pay any local taxes. And last year,
they hardly pay any taxes at all.
They pay not a dime in federal taxes, yeah, either last year.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're doing it right in front of us. They're ripping out the middle class in this country. And they're just shifting everything north. And, you know, and they're strip mining these, you know, large corporations like BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, which own everything. They own 88% of the S&P 500. They're now trying to buy every single family home in this country. They're driving the housing price up. That's what's causing the homelessness crisis in this state. This state has 12% of the United States population. It has 50% of the unsheltered homeless.
Yeah.
Why is that? It's not because of drug addiction. There's more drug addiction in West Virginia and they don't have homeless. It's not because of poverty. There's more poverty in Detroit and West Virginia and they don't have a homelessness problem. It's directly the result of the price of housing. In this county, the median price of a home is $815,000. That means that you have to make about $250,000 a year to be able to afford a home. So, you know, if you're a hotel maid, if you work in a restaurant, if you work in a hair salon, you can't live here anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and the average rent here is $2,500. I talked to the, you know, the women who are changing the sheets at the Fairmont Hotel in Santa Monica, and they're, you know, they're commuting 2 hours every day from Palmdale and Victorville. And they're sleeping in their cars during the week to avoid paying the gas on the way home. And you drive anywhere in Los Angeles and you'll see people living in campers.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's 525,000 homelessness now, but there's 35 million Americans who are on the edge of homelessness. Today, the average income in this country is $5,000 less than the cost of living. And so more than half Americans have a $5,000 just to get food, shelter, and gas. They have a $5,000 deficit at the end of the year, and they're putting that on their credit cards. They're paying 22% interest to Visa and MasterCard.
Yeah.
Which, if the mafia was charging you that, it'd be called loan sharking.
Right.
And they go to jail. But, you know, and who owns all those companies? BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. They own everything. And they're going to own everything. We're going to own nothing. And we're going to be happy according to them.
So this week, you sent a letter to the Democratic National Committee saying that you want them to be more transparent. You want to be included in the debates. And let's open up this process. Have you gotten a response back from them?
No.
Do you expect one?
In some dreamy place in my heart, I hope they'll respond. The letter that I sent, I think almost 3 million people have read it now.
Yeah.
It's, you know, very conciliatory. And, you know, the Democrat Party has been my home for my whole life. My father, my uncles, all the way back to my great grandfather, Honey Fitz, was the first Irish Catholic mayor of Boston.
Right.
You know, my other great grandfather, Patrick Kennedy, was a ward boss in Boston. And, you know, the Democratic Party has been a home to my family since we came over in 1848 during the potato famine.
Right. Probably the most iconic Democratic family of all. So you're a Democrat. You're running for the Democratic nomination. One thing almost every Democrat agrees on is that Joe Biden is better than Donald Trump, even if Joe Biden isn't perfect, and that Donald Trump, most Democrats think, is a threat to democracy. Do you agree with that?
Well, here's what I say, is we've got to stop governing by fear, using fear as a governing tool, and we've got to stop running on fear. That if you, you know, if you don't, if everybody doesn't stay in line,
right,
that this, you know, boogeyman is going to take over our country. You know, we can't, we have to have democracy in our country. We have to have a lot of people running and a lot of people talking to each other and debating and have unscripted interactions.
Right.
With American voters, and we need to have, at this time in our history, there's so many people who have doubts about the political process, and, you know, doubts that feel that the democracy is rigged, the economy is rigged against them, and that this country, which is supposed to be the exemplary democracy in the globe,
right,
that we can't afford to have real democracy anymore because, you know, this guy's going to take over. You know, I'm worried about Brett, that our country is going to be governed not by somebody who is, you know, fully has the, you know, the mental fluidity and the acuity and the dexterity that is required to govern this country, and that the country instead will be governed by a bunch of faceless technocrats with lanyards who nobody's ever heard of, who are making decisions about whether or not to bring us to nuclear Armageddon. And we're very, very close to that right now. And I want, you know, a president up there who can make those decisions and who's gonna understand everything, you know, the entire landscape. And I think President Biden needs to show us all that he, you know, he has that capacity. There are so many doubts, so many Americans have doubts about that. And I think 70% have questions about his mental acuity. And, you know, I'm not going to make a judgment one way or the other, but what I would say is he needs to come out of the White House and answer that question. He needs to have unscripted, you know, he needs to have town halls and unscripted interactions. And you shouldn't be able to run for president. And the only Americans you're talking to are your donors.
Yeah.
You know, there are people suffering in this country, and it's not the donor class. He needs to talk to other Americans, Americans who are cutting up their prescription pills and taking half of the dose because they have to choose between their medicine and their food. They have to choose between their gasoline and their food. These are people who see the engine light come right on their cars, and it is the end of the world for them.
So, but if the final choice is Trump versus Biden, right now you're undecided?
If it's Trump for, I don't have a plan B. I intend to win right this election, and I'm not going to talk about what I'm going to do if that doesn't happen.
One of the things you have been talking a lot about is immigration. You went to the border, and we were there in Beverly Hills as you unveiled this documentary. You're going to be talking more about the issue of immigration here this week in Southern California as well. What struck you most being at the border and seeing it for yourself?
Well, you know, let me say this first. You know, my father was very close to Cesar Chavez, and I worked with Cesar Chavez on pesticide issues on and off during the last 20 years of his life. But he had two big issues back then. One was pesticides, which disproportionately impact Hispanic farm workers, and the other was closing the border, because he understood that having an open border was undermining his capacity and his leverage to negotiate for his workers. So, you know, this idea that we're being, you know, that it's a humanitarian benefit to have an open border is not true. And when I went down there, I saw the chaos and the, you know, that this is a humanitarian crisis, and the people who are the worst victims are the people who are coming across. And I'll tell you why. First of all, they're coming from all over the world. Right. I saw 300 people come over in 2 hours. And they were being brought to the border on buses, 55 in a bus, by the Mexican drug cartels, which now control our borders. They advertise on YouTube and TikTok all over the world and say, send us $15,000, we'll get you into the United States. And everybody who came across knew exactly what was going to happen to them, because it's all outlined on TikTok. They come across, they don't have asylum claims. They don't even pretend to. I interviewed, you know, them, all these people from Africa, Asia, all over the world. They're here to get jobs. What happens to them? They come across the border. The Border Patrol would totally demoralize. 9 of them have committed suicide in the last year, according to what we were told. They bring them to the Yuma airport, put them on an airplane, and to any destination they want, United States. And if they don't have the money, we pay for it, the taxpayer. On the way here, I heard stories from them. They had been exploited, extorted, robbed, beaten. People's whole life savings, a Peruvian family had been taken and raped. And I spent a day at the rape center where they treat the people who have been raped by the drug cartels, children and women. It's horrific. Then they go to New York. They're given a court date 7 years in the future because we do not have the asylum judges to adjudicate at the border. Mm-hmm. They're here now in the country, but they have no legal status, so they can't work. So they're targeted by unscrupulous employers who pay them $5 or $6 an hour at a construction site or to, you know, clean rooms. And that employer then can underbid a union employer who has to pay union wages. And so the whole system, you know, everybody gets messed up. And now, you know, there's 110,000 migrants in New York City. Eric Adams, who originally said, the mayor, originally said that we're a sanctuary city, is now saying this is going to destroy New York. There's encampments now on the playing fields of Randall's Island. We have kids in New York who are, you know, many of whom were scholarship trajectory, who have not been able to play their sports for 2 years because of the pandemic. Now they can't get on the fields where they have to play those sports, as they're crowded with migrants. So everything about this is, $6 an hour, which they're getting paid, is not enough to get them off the sidewalk. So it is a humanitarian disaster, and it's bad for our country, it's bad for them. There's 7 million have come across in 3 years since President Biden opened the border. In that time, only 3.1 million legal immigrants come across. We need to make it easier for legal immigrants. We need to make it quicker for people who are here to get citizenship. But we need to close the borders, slam shut. And I can do that. And, you know, I've talked about how I'm going to do it. And but it can be done. It can be done quite easily.
Is it time to stop the policy of catch and release, where essentially they get the folks there and they kind of let them go?
Well, they're not even catching them. I mean, people just come across and they're processed. The Border Patrol doesn't send people back. And that's crazy.
Well, that's the point, that it's catch and release, that they see them and they don't send them back.
Well, yeah, I mean, people shouldn't be allowed in.
Yeah.
You know, and if you stop people, you stop making it so easy to get in, the drug cartels can't advertise, and it will stop. It will dry up overnight. You know, the other thing that we need to do here, and that, you know, I've talked about that I'm going to do immediately, is to make it easy to waive the fee for passports, passport cards, a federal photo ID. And, you know, if you don't have a federal photo ID or a photo ID, government-issued photo ID, you're a second-class citizen. You can't get a bank account. You can't go into a hotel. You can't take an airplane. You can't see your kids at school. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to make it easy. A lot of the urban poor, particularly that don't have driver's licenses, can't get ID. I'm going to make sure everybody can get a federal ID who wants it for free immediately. And what that'll do is it'll make it so work sites now, like a construction site in New York, if you go to that site, you're an illegal immigrant. All you show is a Social Security card. They're easily fabricated. They don't have a photo on them. They're passed hand to hand. And the employers know they're fake, but all they have to do is check the box. Oh, but if you say you can't get a job without a federal ID, the border's going to shut down overnight. Because now, you know, the employer's going to go to jail. If he employs you, you don't have that, and you can't get it unless you're a U.S. citizen. It'll also do something else. This idea is supported by Andrew Young, by Al Sharpton, by all the civil rights leaders. It will make it so that we can tell people you need an ID to vote, and it will calm down the feelings on both sides, because everybody will be able to get an ID. And at the voting booth, they'll say, show us your ID, and there won't be any more worry about whether or not there's double voting going on.
since we're the California politics show, I'll ask you one California politics question. Governor Newsom was on Meet the Press this weekend talking about his reverence for your father and his longstanding relationship with you, and that, you know, there has been some challenges in that in the last few years. What's the nature of your relationship with the governor? What do you think of him?
You know, I've always had a friendly relationship with Governor Newsom and his wife, and you know, and his dad, and you know, we've collaborated a lot on environmental issues. I have a lot of friends like that in the Democratic Party, and who I disagree with their policies. I disagree with the way that he handled COVID. I disagree with his support for censorship, which I don't think is part of the Democratic Party tradition. I very much disagree with his support for the war in Ukraine. And so, you know, but I have family members that disagree with me about that too, and it hasn't destroyed my relationship. I saw that Governor Newsom it seemed like he was upset at me about, he considered unfair or personal some of the criticism I'd levied about him and COVID, about the way he handled COVID. I feel bad that he feels that way. I feel like my criticisms of him have been policy-based and not personal. And I thought what he said about me this week on Meet the Press, some of it was very, very sweet, and I was grateful for that.
And I know he said to me several times that his most prized possession of all is a photo of your dad and his dad together shortly before.
Yeah, I mean, I loved his dad.
Yeah, who was a judge.
And Gavin, it's a big Irish Catholic family. And,
right.
I just have a lot in common with him and a lot of, affection for him. But I don't like the decisions he's made recently, and he doesn't like the decisions I made, and that's okay.
Yeah. We are talking with Robert Kennedy Jr. I feel like I have to ask you just a couple questions about your family and what you've learned from them. I know you've studied all of them very intensely. And we play a game called the name game, where we usually just come up with one word when you think of something. But if you can think of a sentence or two in terms of the most important leadership lesson from some of your family members. Let's try that. And if we could start with your father, the most important leadership lesson you learned from him.
I think my dad, I wanted us to understand that the path to happiness, the path to self-esteem is through service to others. That life was not about just making a big pile for yourself and whoever dies with the most stuff wins. That, we're here to build something, and that the most important thing that we can build is character.
Yeah.
And that, my dad gave me a book right before he died. He gave me a book by Camus called The Plague. And he told me with a particular intensity, I want you to read this. And The Plague was about a doctor in North Africa who was in a quarantine city during a plague that was destroying the city, and he had to make a moral choice because he didn't know how to treat it, nobody did, about whether he would just go out and minister to the sick even though he couldn't help them. And he ends up doing that. Camus was an existentialist, which were the heirs to the Stoics, and Camus wrote another book about Sisyphus, who's kind of the hero, the iconic hero of the Stoics. And Sisyphus was doomed because of something he did good for humanity, to push a boulder up the hill for the rest of his life and never get to the top. It would roll down every night, and he'd have to roll it back. But in the minds of the Stoic, Sisyphus was a happy man, because even though he was engaged in a hopeless task with an absurd universe, he had put his shoulder to the stone.
Wow.
And he was doing his duty. He was doing what he was supposed to do, and he was building character.
Right. Yeah.
And I think my dad taught me that the only thing that we build that is durable, that is meaningful, that is lasting, is character.
Wow.
and that if we do build that, you know, your money can always be taken away. Your fame can always, you know, be, all of those things are wormwood and bile.
Yeah.
And that the only thing that endures forever, even presumably after we die, is the character that we build when we're here.
A couple other ones, and I'll try to do this rapid fire. Most important lesson from President John F. Kennedy?
The most important lesson is what he wanted as his epithet. He kept the peace. He said the primary job of a president of the United States is to keep our country out of war.
Most important lesson from Senator Edward Kennedy?
From Teddy, it was perseverance and compassion. And, he spent a lifetime. Let me put it this way. Let me say something about Teddy. Teddy Kennedy, who's the most controversial of my relatives, but he was in the Senate for 50 years.
Before you, maybe.
He has more. He has more bills named after him, more piece of legislation than any other senator in United States history. The way he did that is because he was able to reach across the aisle. Yeah. So he would bring people home who, you know, I was an environmental advocate, and they, you know, people like Orrin Hatch and John Kasich. To me, those guys were like Darth Vader.
Right.
And I was like, Teddy, how can you hand out with these people who are destroying the planet and engage in all these kind of cruelties toward humanity? But he liked them, and he saw other parts of them besides their political ideology, and he formed these incredible friendships with them, and he was able to see the things that they had in common, the values they had in common, rather than focusing on the little issues that were keeping them apart. And I would say that, to me, that's the most important lesson, and it's something I've tried to do my whole life, to talk to people with whom I don't agree. Know, to go on Fox News,
right,
and talk to people that I have differences with, and speak to those audiences, and, you know, do it in a way that's congenial, that's respectful, and that looks for commonalities.
One family member that has said a lot of positive things to me about you, or used to be a family member, I guess, is Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. What do you think is the most important lesson from him?
Well, you know, The most important lesson for him, I think, is that anybody would learn was discipline, self-discipline. Yeah. And, you know, he, if you look at the documentary on him that is now on Netflix, which I watched with Cheryl, and we both agreed, we both watch a lot of documentaries, we both agreed it was one of the most, the best documentaries we've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's a very, very moving portrait of him. And
he credits you as one of the leaders
that's a minor part, and he gives me too much credit for that. But, you know, Arnold is an amazing dad to his kids, and his kids love him. And, you know, he's in so many ways, you know, he's like all of us, he's has his flaws, and because of who he is, those flaws are known by everybody.
Right.
And yet, you know, he's continued to live his life in a way that is joyful, that embraces new experience, and that, you know, that leads with kindness and gentleness toward other people and compassion.
Final family member, your wife, Cheryl Hines. What's the most important thing you've learned from her? What's the most important thing you've learned from her?
You know, I learn something new from her every day, but she is... all of the character, all of the aspirations that I have, she seems to have been born with. And she's the most honest human being that I've ever met. I've never seen her or heard her say something that was pretentious or that was even slightly exaggerated or dishonest. You know, to me, that's, I read a long time ago, I read many, many years ago, an obituary that C.S. Lewis wrote, the theologian and writer wrote about a friend of his, and he described him as honest as daylight. And when I read that, I said, wow, you know, I wish somebody would say that about me more than anything else. I wish somebody would say about that about me. And, you know, when I met Cheryl and got to know her, I thought, this is a person who you would say that about.
Yeah. And Larry David was a part of that, right? You guys were close friends.
Yeah, Larry introduced me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he didn't intend to, you know, it wasn't like a blind date where I think, although when I went and asked him for permission to date her, because I knew he has all these little rules that I knew that would, that aren't written down anywhere, but you're supposed to know them. And I right. knew that would be one of his rules because it was his television wife. Yeah. And I went and into the car. I met him at like around midnight at the Carlyle Hotel in New York. He was shooting there that year. And I asked his permission to date Cheryl, and he said to me, you know, I'm really happy, and that's the she's the best person I've ever met. He said she's beloved in Hollywood. She's the only person in that industry that doesn't have a single enemy. And he was, you know, he was telling me the truth then, but I don't think he was being honest that he was happy that I was dating her. And later, yeah, so. I think he was probably slightly horrified. And when Cheryl asked him, he had a different answer for it. He said, that'll never work.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Curb episode?
I have a episode that I was actually, you know, instrumental in inspiring with Larry. This one in particular was... I was telling Larry one time about about my first case as an attorney, where I was suing a ski area for a client who had gotten injured. And most places with ski areas have shield laws because they're a rural industry that's very important. Yeah. So the states pass laws to make sure that nobody can sue them, that you assume the risk. If you break your leg, it's your fault, yeah. not theirs. It was very hard to find somebody who had successfully sued a ski area. And I found there was a ski area in New York called Bel Air. And there were two Hasidic Jews, who got on a chairlift. It was in the middle of the summer.
Yeah.
And they, there had been another Hasidic couple who had gone on before them.
Yeah.
And the guy at the bottom of the lift wired the guy at the top and said, on the last group is a Hasidic couple. Right. So when the Hasidic couple got off, he shut off the lift and hiked down. And he left the pair on a lift overnight. And they were at the highest point of the lift. And there was an argument that they had because there was a stigma in that sect that a single man can't be with a single woman after sundown.
Yeah.
But the stigma is on the woman.
Mm.
And so the man didn't want to jump. And eventually the woman jumped and she was grievously injured. And wow. I was telling that to Larry and he ended up making an episode about that.
There you go. This is the last thing to just real quick, rapid fire cultural favorites. It's a game we call Personal Issues. So here we go. First thing that comes to mind, what's your favorite TV show other than Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Like right now?
Yeah, or of all time, either one.
You know, I watched a TV show recently that I really like, but I change all the time, but I love this show called The Patriot.
Very nice.
I think there's a couple shows of that, but this was it was a series.
Who's your all-time favorite musical artist?
I think I'd have to say Eric Clapton.
Very nice. What's your favorite movie of all time?
The Godfather.
Great choice. Favorite athlete?
Maybe... Saving Private Ryan, too.
Okay. Both are good. Do you have a favorite athlete?
Aaron Rodgers.
And what a week for him. And he's a supporter of you, too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good reason to like him. And what is your favorite quote or motto?
Live free or die.
Robert F. Kennedy, thank you so much for having us here. Really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for
being so open.
Our thanks to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and our thanks to you for listening. We also spoke this week with North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. We posted that as a separate podcast. We hope you will check that out. He, of course, a Republican presidential candidate. We'll see you back here next week for more of The Issue Is.